The truth of the matter is that the more we learn about this awful billionaire agenda and this awful billionaire raid of our communities, the more all of us should have reason to be pissed off and to rise up and to demand leadership that is going to fight for and with working people.
Give out a website where people can find out more about these actions that are taking place this week. I imagine you'll have more coming up in the future.
Yes, they can go to We Are California, and that's wearecalifornia.org. They can sign up, they can join. I mean, if you're watching this right now, I invite you to join. We Are California is a movement made by all of us. So you can join us and help us build We Are California and help us defend the things that we love and care about and the things that are so important to us in our community and in this state.
Well, we'll post a link to that as well from our website. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been João Paulo Connolly, Organizing Director at Working Partnerships USA and a member of We Are California. I'm Sonali.
This is Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my email. It is often mentioned as one of the most progressive and daring stations that we have in this country. They are not afraid to tell you the truth. So tune in to KBOO Portland and get the real word.
As part of the All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, Comics Take co-host comedian Kimberly Nickel is producing a stand-up comedy show celebrating Women's History Month with a full cast of not dude comedians, sharing their best PG-13 rated jokes. The show will be live for an audience on Friday, March 28th at 6:30 p.m. Set your intentions, save your seat, RSVP at kbu.fm/comedy. KBU Studio will be filled with an audience enjoying puns, impressions, and cocktails. It'll be better with you there. Join us in the back of KBU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. In Portland, on Friday, March 28th, 6:30 p.m. This event will be recorded and played on the radio waves on Monday, March 31st at 10 p.m. Donations to KBOO are encouraged. If you don't show up on the 28th, no one will hear your laughter on the 31st.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO. 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop, so you keep it locked.
I'm Eddie Zane.
And I'm Helen Zia.
And we are on Hard Knock Radio.
I just want to say peace and blessings upon everybody. This is Michelle and Dege Ocello, and I'm just here trying to have a peaceful journey on Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I wanted to play a classic from the one and only Roberta Flack, First Time I Ever Saw Your Face, and kind of set the tone for one of my favorite people, music historian, author, funketeer. He's that guy, Ricky Vincent. If you're in the Bay Area, you can hear him on Friday nights, The History of Funk. If there's anything about music you need to know, he can break it down for you, man, you know. And this afternoon, we want to continue with the tributes that we've been laying out. We are looking at a large number of people who have passed in a very short period of time. Roy Ayers, we're talking about Gwen McCrae, we're talking about Angie Stone, and right now we're looking at Roberta Flack, and you know, and then we have Jerry Butler, and there's a whole bunch of folks that we've seemed to have lost really quickly. But I wanted to start off with Roberta Flack. She's somebody to me that has always been a very powerful voice, but she isn't often mentioned in the pantheons of powerful singers. You know, we go Aretha, we go Diana, we name everybody. And then somebody goes, don't forget Roberta Flack. And you go, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. She was cool, too. But to me, she was something else. And I'm glad we have you to, you know, help shed some light. So welcome to the show, Ricky.
Happy to be here, Davey D.
You know, if we talk about Roberta Flack, what do you say about her?
When we say Roberta Flack, I think she had an album title called Quiet Fire. And that's kind of the mental image that I get. Her songs, her compositions, her hit records always seem to have this peaceful, quiet quality about them. And but there was always a little kick, a little extra, you know, spice in there that you knew this was a sister doing what she did. What she did was lovely and soulful and smooth, but it never felt like she was from the other side of the tracks.
When did you first become aware of her?
Probably, I became aware of Roberta Flack probably through her ballads on the radio. Like I said, first time I ever saw her face. And you know, I was into my hits, my R&B, my funk tracks, my jumping, bumping things. And at that time, there was this whole new rowdy sound. It had electronics in it and everything. And here she comes with this acoustic sound. I could tell even as an 8-9-year-old that was like a stand-up bass that she had as her backup. And I was like, what is she doing? Well, I don't know what she's doing, but I'm just going to soak it all in. You know, it was never like, oh, Roberta Flack, I'm not going to play that. There was never that feeling. It was always like, you know, I can feel this woman. I'm into my rowdy phase, but I can flow with this woman right here.
You know, one of the things that, well, two things. I started off by saying, and I think you kind of touched upon it, Ricky, like she shows up at a time that seems to be in sharp contradiction to everything else that's going on. It's rowdy time, it's turn up time before there's even a word turn up, right? Funk is slapping and here's Roberta Flack, you know? She's from the South, you know, and the South has its own, you know, persona in terms of how people start to, you know, view it. You're thinking Memphis and, you know, or, you know, what, you know, not Memphis, what's the other? Florida is a hot spot and, you know, Georgia and all that. And of course, you know, it's like, is she from New York? Nah, she's from North Carolina. So that seems to be some contradictions there. And then she's quiet, but she's also somebody who is a student leader at Howard University. So, you know, I guess it brings down to a couple of questions. One, is she a continuation of Black music expression, or is she somebody who expands the definition of it when we start to talk about Black music?
Well, Dave, you're from the East Coast, and you know there's a whole thread of Black arts that is tied into HBCUs, tied into a notion of sophistication going all the way back to the Harlem Renaissance. tied into respectability politics that's kind of woven into a sense of accomplishment. It's a necessity of sort of having that kind of respectability politics involved in your in your presentation of who you are. And I think Roberta Flack quietly satisfies all of those requirements, if you will, of accomplishment that were sort of embedded in these Black traditions. And at some point, you know, when we're radical, we just want to smash the edifice. We want to smash the whole statue. But actually, she is showing you this is how it's done. Yeah, I don't remember the people actively linking her to people like Lena Horne and folks that we might have associated with you know, grace and class from the previous generations, because she was, in her own way, a self-defined soul sister, but she just didn't do it the way other people did it. And Dave, it's interesting that you mentioned she's from the South, because it's kind of easy to take a look at the particularly that generation coming out of the 50s and 60s and into the 70s of the Southern soul that was more raw, and the Northern soul that people associated with Motown and Smokey Robinson and the smooth harmonies of the Delphonics and Shy Lights out of Chicago and people like that. And so there was a whole tradition of smooth music from the Northern cities and a tradition of raw music from the Southern cities. And It just so happened that sometimes the exception proves the rule. Patti LaBelle is from the Philly area, but she really didn't really get going until people got wind of her raw voice that we associate with the South. Aretha Franklin's from Detroit, and she toiled for years trying to do this jazz thing that her father put her into. But once she got to Alabama and did the Memphis Shoals things, it just started to take off, because people got the raw, real Aretha. And it's interesting that Roberta Flack, yeah, she's from North Carolina, born like an hour from where Nina Simone was born, but she had that sound that we also celebrated, but we typically celebrated that with these Northern artists that were busy showing their sophistication in that regional way, that great migration thing all the way to the North. Roberta Flack, she just had all the boxes filled, and you knew she wasn't faking it. So you said, okay, go ahead, sister.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Nina Simone and, you know, the famous story with her that she too wanted to be kind of a classical, you know, pianist at one point, until she got a talking to from what's the sister's name? It's not Lena Horne. It is Raven in the Sun. What is the sister's name with Raven in the Sun? You know I'm talking about.
Lorraine Hansberry
talks to her because, you know, she's involved with Dr. King and his movement, and they had that situation in 63 at the church with the four girls that get bombed, and they're like, and then, you know, Lorraine is talking to Nina, and it's like, what you gonna do, you know, what, how you gonna step up and be involved? And you know, the end result was that she winds up recording Mississippi Goddamn, and it's like a far removed, you know, step from where she was going, but she was political ever since, and becomes like the, you know, the high priestess of soul and all that. I bring this up because one of the things that my first introduction to Roberta Flack was more on a political tip. And, you know, I grew up in the 70s and I would hear this song called Business Goes On As Usual, which was on, you know, my favorite album from her, which is Chapter 2. Sister had some stuff to say, and she was definitely speaking about that war in Vietnam. So a couple of questions for you, Rick. Did somebody have to talk to her to get busy? And, you know, and how does, you know, her doing this seems to kind of be around the same time that famous guy like Marvin Gaye is asking what's going on, you know, people speaking out about the war and all that. So I'm just trying to really understand that trajectory into, you know, having a message and meaningful politics, you know, in your presentation.
With Roberta Flack, you put her record on and you trusted her. You said this woman is going to be a high quality product, and it has all this classical music training, all this mastery of you know, melodies and chords and musicianship. All her
was she producing a lot of this, or
she was making these records with some of the best performers and producers in the business. And it felt like it was her vision as it came out. But it's really, again, it's quiet the way it is. If you get her first record called First Take, the first song there is a Compared to What, which is this very powerful social message tune written by Eugene McDaniels. And she worked multiple times with Eugene McDaniels, and the things that she did with Donny Hathaway, of course, all you'd have to do is hit a note with Donny Hathaway and people could feel you, they know that you're doing it real,
right?
So you always trusted her, and she was one of those people that just lets you know on their terms where their hopes are, where their vision is. I'm not going to say where their politics are, because she kept them kind of close. And at the time, it was cool. Later on, there was a little dust up when I think she performed for one of the Republican inaugurations some down the road. And I was like, well, she was on that path. I'll give the sister a pass at that time. Just keep it moving.
Was she a Republican, or she just...
No, your people get invited to those all the time.
And right.
It might have been Reagan, might have been Bush. And it just... like I said, it wasn't your deal breaker. It wasn't like when James Brown endorsed Richard Nixon and people felt an epic betrayal at that
right.
point. But that was who she was. And this is the thing. There are always performers and entertainers and public figures that you take anything past the surface, take a look at them, and you're like, well, you're being coached. You're being coached up. Somebody is managing your presentation there. And, you know, I don't know how much I'm actually getting you, that type of thing. Never felt that way in the 70s. You always felt, as much as Rick James and Tina Marie had this relationship that went back and forth on their albums back in the day, you felt like Roberta Flack had that on and off work relationship with Donny Hathaway. That had more to do with Donny Hathaway's issues than anything else. But it felt like, oh, we got Donny and Roberta doing that thing, and this feels just right. We go enjoy it, because we don't know how long that's going to last.
I was going to ask you about that. We're talking with Ricky Vincent, doing our look back at some of the people who have passed. So I had mentioned, you know, Marvin Gaye comes out, what's going on, but his muse is Terry Terrell, and sadly, she leaves, you know, prematurely. You mentioned Rick James and Tina Marie, another dynamic duo, but Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway, you know, another dynamic duo. In this case, it's the exact opposite of Marvin Gaye. It's Donny who leaves us prematurely. But what was that about? And, you know, what stood out about that relationship in terms of music? Or did they even have, were they dating or anything, or just?
I don't think so. It was just a love that they had. And, you know, Donnie had a love for the world that troubled him so much. He couldn't put it together. And he was diagnosed with this and that and the other. And it's tough as a consumer, you know, when they leave us good, it's like, well, where you been? How come you haven't entertained me lately? That type of thing. But it was one of those things where they had a soul rhythm together. And if you will, Donnie brought, you know, a lot of if people had any, you know, concerns that Roberta Flack was sort of over on the pop side of things, on the middle of the road side of things, Donnie could bring her back, because there's nothing more soulful than Where Is the Love, the song they did together.
Right.
It stands on its own as perfection to me. And so we understood that. And if she's going to do some easy listening music, well, of course it's easy to listen to, but that doesn't mean it's molasses. That doesn't mean it's, bleached out.
I can't call her easy to listen music. Because you had to listen and be like, yo, she's saying something. Well, she's saying some stuff, you know?
But it's quietly done. It's gentle, even though it has a soul power. And that, to me, it just was a testament to how much of a range and how much of a depth soul music had at that time. Mm. She was a contemporary of Bill Withers. Bill Withers wasn't the smooth crooning, hair grease slick back type of brother. He was a down home country guy, and yet he belonged completely to the experience, to the community, to the people. And so I felt that way about Roberta Flack. Now the fact that she collected all the Grammy awards for soul music at that time, that was a bit of an irony, but it wasn't necessarily. It was like, okay, well, that means Curtis Mayfield ain't gonna get nothing. But we love him. We understand that. We understand that. You know that she's over there in that realm of crossover acceptance, and we have those issues, and we're concerned when certain entertainers or people that don't come from the community get the awards that supposedly represent that community. But that didn't really. It was just a bit of an irony that so many talents of our whole range were rising at the same time, and then the outsiders just sort of cream off that little slice of our sound that was Roberta Flack, winning all those awards for great music.
That's the voice of Ricky Vincent. I'm going to try and play Donnie Hathaway and Roberta Flack's song, Where's the Love, and also Business as Usual. And I want to come back and I want to talk to you about another guy.
Let me know. business goes on as usual. The corn and the profits are high, and TVs boom in every living room. They tell us what deodorants to buy. Business goes on as usual, except that my brother is dead. He was 25 and very much alive, but the dreams have all been blasted from his head. In a far off land with a gun died in a war he did not understand. While business goes on as usual, there's plenty to choose from the rack, but rumor goes that the latest thing in clothes, the latest thing in clothes will be black. But business goes on as usual, as usual, as usual.
We're back here, Hard Knock Radio, looking back at some of the people that we've lost in recent days. Here with Ricky Vincent. He does the history of funk if you're here in the Bay Area on Friday nights on KPFA. The author of a couple of books, Party Music and On the One. You got a third book coming, man? You do a third book, man.
Well, it's bouncing around, Davey. We got so much to say right about now. People need to find out what do we have to say coming from the Bay more than ever? So I'm nibbling.
Okay. So there's a guy named Jerry Butler. You had mentioned Curtis Mayfield. And The Impressions is a group that I think is also underrated. Jerry and Curtis are landmark figures in themselves. Really, you know, the first to be like, we're putting some messages in these music, you know, so they're out there, like they're Public Enemy before there was Public Enemy in terms of like, let's put some, you know, we're going to say something. And Curtis continued on that path. But Jerry Butler was no slouch. What do we know about him? And, you know, when you hear that name, Jerry Butler, what stands out for you? We lost him last week or the other week as well.
I think of Only the Strong Survive. And that was an important record from him. And the fact that, like you said, that Jerry Butler and Curtis Mayfield really put together what a lot of soul aficionados call the Chicago sound. Mm. And it had to do with these harmonies that are soft, but they belie the strength in the music. And Jerry Butler had, he belonged, you know, if he was a decade later, Well, actually, a decade later, he did wind up on Philadelphia International Records, where Teddy Pendergrass was.
Right. And
he might have been a Teddy Pendergrass type had he, you know, recorded a bit later. But he was one of those honorable soul, you know, masters. And when it came on, or if you listen to some of his songs, he hits that next octave of depth when he has to hit that bridge and take it to another level. He does that, and you're like, whoa, okay, that's why I'm listening to Jerry Butler right here. And so it was something special, because Curtis, it's awkward because Prince is like this. Some of his music is extremely powerful, but he won't go an octave lower. He won't go way down, because that's just not the pocket that he's in. And Curtis has the messages, but sometimes you need a little bit of you know, the gravel in the road to show how much dirt you got to deliver it with. So they had a real simpatico early on, and then the way Chicago soul music emerged was really a result of Curtis Mayfield, Jerry Butler, and the way the Impressions said, this is how you're supposed to do it.
A lot of people come out of Chicago, you know, was he a contemporary of Sam Cooke? You know, were they in the same space at that time, Butler and then Curtis and all of them, or were they kind of, you know, years apart?
Sam Cooke was the pioneer.
Okay.
Sam Cooke had his own, you know, situation coming out of the gospel thing, which he had, because they told him the devil's gonna get you if you leave the church now. Don't even try it. But he was Sam Cooke was just so so delectable as an artist. People loved him. That he tried to record. Sam Cooke tried to record music under a different name, and they said, "Don't even bother. We can tell. We can feel you when you sing. Don't even go there."
Right. I think he used his brother's name, Dale Cooke, or something like that.
He tried. Yeah. He tried differently, but he was well on his way to establishing his independence as an artist. And so Sam Cooke was one of the few that owned his own publishing, ahead of the game. And one of the others that followed in that path was Curtis Mayfield. And if you remember Superfly and some of the greats that Curtis did, that was on Kurtom Records, at his own record company. And we bought it. We didn't care that it wasn't on, you know, Columbia, or wasn't on Capitol Records. You know, it was his own, you know, business, essentially. And so I'm convinced that there was a conversation back in the day, but I haven't seen a recognition or one night in Miami type of thing where that conversation happened. But I do know that Sam Cooke was not only serious about becoming an independent artist, but he spent time with other artists, showing them this is how you really need to do it. And not everybody was in a position to take advantage of that, or to listen to the point where they could do it. But that was a tradition. That was an independent tradition that Sam Cooke led the fight, really. And Curtis Mayfield really did, I think, the most with it out of that soul era out of Chicago.
Right, and Jerry Butler right along with him. You know, we had talked earlier about some of the political leanings, and I guess we'd be remiss to not remind people that Jerry Butler served as a commissioner for Cook County, which is in Chicago, for a number of years. So they said he chaired the Health and Hospitals Committee and served as the vice chair for the construction. So he did more than just singing. He got his political chops together as well. But I want to come back to this Chicago sound. A couple of things come to mind. One, Jerry grows up, he's from Mississippi, but he grows up in Cabrini Green, the now defunct housing projects. And Cabrini Green has an interesting thing. You know, some people say it's like the Brewster Projects of Detroit, so a lot of talent comes from there. One, there's a house music cover. I'm going to remember the group, you know, that did it, but they have Cabrini Green, and it's letting them know, like, yo, you know, this sound comes from the people. Like, Cabrini Green is going to be the essence of that. But you also have Jerry coming from there and attributing some of his upbringing to the Cabrini Green and, as you said, developing that Chicago sound. Two questions. One, do you feel like Jerry lays groundwork for either the stepping movement that we associate with Chicago or later the house music scene? And two, how would you compare the Chicago sound with the Philly sound? Because, you know, Jerry eventually went and, you know, was on the Philly label.
That's interesting that the Chicago is where, and Philly to an extent, a lot of that house music sound, people say it grew out of disco. People say it grew out of, you know, the club scene and the DJs and this and that. Well, they had to have been raised in some kind of music. And yeah. Then it doesn't sound like those DJs were raised listening to Funkadelic. It sound like those DJs were raised listening to the crooners, to the harmonies of disco. I mean, of soul singers.
Well, we called it black disco. Soul singers. Yeah, we called it black disco because okay. There was a distinction between, you know, the John Travolta, mm-hmm. Bee Gees thing. And that Philadelphia sound, which, you know, was very popular early on, Mother, Father, Sister, Brother, and right. all that. But, you
and
know.
What you can do, I mean, it's kind of not really. It's a kind of an interesting thing to do. But you could take a song like The Love I Lost and slow it down and realize that's a blues type of tune. It's just upbeat. It's got a disco beat. And so a lot of what became the house music was songs, soul songs with those highs, with those exhilarating moments to them. And then the DJs just sort of held on to those high moments and said, well, let me give you a whole mix of this.
Right.
And so it was sort of built on the soul foundation. And they put this new beat on it. And that's not atypical. It's not atypical of the black music tradition. A lot of reggae music out of Jamaica was American soul harmonies that the singers back in the 60s in Jamaica were studying carefully, but they put the big bottom reggae beats underneath it. But they were studying all those vocals. Let me get that feel. Let me get the feel. And that's essential to the music, however you want to spin it. So it would be a real enjoyable thing to watch one of those house music, one of those Chicago DJs kind of walk through some of their roots, some of their musical roots, which is the melodic and the soulful roots of that Midwestern Northern soul that was part of their, you know, the building blocks of what made their creative process happen.
So was the Chicago sound at all similar to the Philly sound in your opinion?
Yeah, I kind of...
I mean, the Chicago soul sound, the Curtis Mayfield.
To me, there's a lost art of this harmonic background vocals thing. When I think of the Shy Lights, have you seen her? When I think of the stylistics and the Delphonics, you know, la 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 la, I love you. They're essential together, and it didn't, as a kid, it didn't make sense how essential they were until, this is corny, but when the Pips left Gladys Knight, I was like, wait a minute, wait, you have to have, Gladys has to have the Pips. Wait, it's not a whole song if the lead and the background aren't all there together.
Wait, the Pips left Gladys Knight?
They stopped recording together in around the 80s.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't check for Gladys in the '80s.
But that was kind of the thing, and because the idea of putting a whole lot of work into the vocals, come on, Dave, let's face it. You know, hip hop kind of moved the vocalist to the side of the stage, and it was less effort, I felt, put into those sounds in the '80s. You could just imitate a tone with your, you know, homemade keyboard and just keep it moving.
Right.
And so some of that was a lost art. But I thought that art, that craft, that Northern soul craft was sort of taking, you know, this tradition of barbershop quartet of harmonizing in these enclosed spaces. Right, that's what a lot of that is from. It's like, you know, in the North, it's cold. You're stuck together. Let's make some music, you know, and get this echo sound in this basement chamber here. Let's make this thing happen. I see a lot of overlap. I felt a lot of overlap between Philly and Chicago and Detroit and some of the other, you know, spots where folks could really you know, get that echo to give you a you know, sort of a hypnotic high out of this music. That's why we make it.
Yeah, well, it's gospel-y like.
Yes.
You know, lastly, as we close out, I know you have mentioned the Bay, and since you're here today, and we're gonna probably do a bigger tribute to Wayne Wiggins. You know, how do you view his musicianship? What was his impact, you know, in the totality of music that you study? And just being a Bay Cat, you know, how important was he to you?
Man, we've crossed paths multiple times, and it's one of those where you always figure this man is a part of my life, our life, and I know we're gonna circle back and really take care of it. But it was a terrible blow. I'm still trying to make sense of it all. Dwayne Wiggins was, first of all, he was this incredible music enabler, and he worked with a lot of skilled artists, and, you know, we've seen her and Zendaya and Beyonce and all these different people he worked with. And of course, his brother and his cousin and Tony. But he was, everything he said and did was the town. Everything he said and did was the roots. If you listen to some Tony music, you're like, okay, well, there's that beat. Okay, well, there's that note that Raphael hits. But then there's that guitar lick that kind of brings you back to some older era. That brings you back to some, wait a minute, he's speaking to me in a different way. And that's because Dwayne Wiggins had that historical knowledge, and he always put that in the sound. So it's as modern as their music was feeling in the 90s, it spoke to generations. And when you come across, you know, him talking about the music, what's he going to do? He's going to talk about Larry Graham. He's going to talk about the Oaktown sound. That's the Oakland Stroke. That's one of their early records.
Yeah.
He understood that, and I believed it. And it's a tough parallel because a lot of folks, when they come into, you know, the Bay Area, try to figure out Bay Area music, they're Sly and the Family Stone, and they don't even get past the next layer, which is Larry Graham, this pioneering innovator in bass guitar and performance, that, and then the whole years of Graham Central Station and what that did to the musicians in the 70s, all of this was this sort of layered knowledge that the musicians all got. They all understood that. All the Bay Area musicians understood Sly and Family Stone was the game changer, but Larry Graham put in the work in the game throughout the 70s and explain how to entertain people with this sound for that next decade. And everybody saw that. And when you hear Dwayne Wiggins. And when you listen to Dwayne Wiggins talk, it's like, oh, he's got that. He's done this. This is why all the music that comes through him has such a rich feel to it. It belongs to us in a certain way because it's from this era, and he's
continuing the tradition to it.
He's continuing the tradition, and it's tough because he was so humble about it. All these other musical things happen because of him, but where's the light? Where's the spotlight? It's not. We don't see him, and he doesn't get that. He doesn't get the spotlight. He didn't then, and so now, it's up to us to kind of wave that flag for Dwayne Wiggins and everything he represented, because he was representing everything that came up to that.
Real talk. There, you mentioned Oakland Stroke. Is there a particular song that you heard him do that you was like, yo, this is us?
First record I bought by them was Hey Little Walter with the 12-inch.
Oh, yeah.
The 12-inch mix had a different kind of New Jack Swing type of beat to it. It had a little more.
But it kind of predated New Jack Swing, right?
They predated it, but they was with that whole, I felt that was the kind of Foster McElroy, like,
yeah,
that's the track. That's the thing. So let's do a little bit of little jazzy style to it. But when I listened to the 12-inch of Hey Little Walter, and then it dawned on me that Hey Little Walter was actually the notes to Wade in the Water, and they were taking a traditional song
right. And
putting something into it. And then the lyrics was about dude who wouldn't pay his rent. I'm like, oh man, this is real talk. In this, high energy upbeat thing that it's on the one, even though it's sniffing that new jazz. Anyway, I was like, okay, these folks know how to put it all together right out the gate, because that was, I think, their first.
That was the first one, I think. Yeah.
I was like, okay, I'm rolling. And that's the thing, people roll with them. They have four albums, all of them gold or platinum, and they had just a couple of the pop crossover hits, and people bought their albums because they wanted them. They wanted everything they had.
Well, we're going to do a whole big special on Dwayne, because he encompassed so much.
Yes.
But since we had you on today, I wanted to at least get a jump start and get your influence on that. If we're talking about Dwayne, do you put him in? Is he a funk guy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. That's the thing. Look at his interviews where he talks about the music. And he'll sit there and say, excuse me, Larry Graham, Larry Graham, Larry Graham. And that says all that needs to be said. Because even funk, even folks that are into the funk, most of that's associated with the East Coast, associated with James Brown in the South, associated with Dayton and Cincinnati and Bootsy and all that. And I got none but love for them. But when you ask all those musicians and all those bands, where'd you get your funk from? Say, well, yeah, it was kind of Sly and the Family Stone. It was kind of Larry Graham. It was okay. He was, Dwayne Wiggins was on point from the get-go.
We've got Ricky Vincent with us. We're going to take a break. We'll come back on Hard Knock Radio. Ricky, where can people hear you?
Friday nights at 10 o'clock. Right here on KPFA. We did a deep dive in the Roy Ayers last Friday, 2 hours.
We're going to do a big one. We got a big one coming up with him as well, so I'm glad you did that. So that'll be good. And we'll check out your archives as well on that. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Tell me what's really going on. Strange fruit, blood on the leaves, blood on the leaves. Society bears no truth. Tell me what's really going on. Me and my amigo went to a comedy show to have a little fun with friends. Ran into a lady who I hadn't seen since. We chopped it up and made big plans.
That's when I found out
cellar trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves, blood on the roots. Society bears no truth.
Tell me what's really going on.
Cellar trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves, blood on the roots. Society bears no truth.
Tell me what's really going on.
I looked into my rearview. Someone's watching me and you. I knew it had to be the man. He told me,
turn your car off.
I wasn't breaking no law. So why'd you have to put your hands on me?
Real Talk Radio, you are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
This is the Fire Sign Theater.
And we're in the Fire Sign Funhouse. I'm Phil Proctor.
I'm Phil Austin.
And I'm Anton Shorthairs.
And this is George Tirebiter.
And we always listen to K-Boo because it's so scary at 90.7 FM.
Boo!
This is Bird Note. The zone-tailed hawk of the American Southwest looks a lot like a turkey vulture. It's dark all over, has a long tail, and soars on long, upward-angled wings while tilting from side to side. And this is where it gets intriguing. Zone-tailed hawks often soar among groups of turkey vultures. But there's a crucial distinction between the two, especially if you happen to be a dove or lizard exposed on the terrain below. While the vultures are searching for carrion, the zone-tailed hawk in their midst is hunting live prey. By consorting with vultures, a zone-tailed hawk gains a distinct advantage as a predator. Because while doves and lizards would quickly flee the flight silhouette of a red-tailed hawk, they seem to ignore the shadow of a vulture overhead, a bird that poses no threat. So, floating among the vultures, a zone-tailed hawk is a sort of wolf in sheep's clothing, and can sneak up on its prey undetected. Just how zone-tailed hawks developed this relationship with turkey vultures isn't clear, but we do know that zone tails occur only within the geographic range of vultures, and they don't just soar with them. They also nest and roost near their scavenging accomplices. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Never miss an episode of Bird Note by subscribing to our podcast. Just search for Bird Note in your podcast app.
To KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/atnfw.